I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. The New York Times is reporting today that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have found important security holes remain in the nation's aviation system, despite the billions of dollars that have been spent since the 9/11 attacks. The joint study issued 2 weeks ago says that al-Qaeda and related groups may be shifting their attention now to chartered planes, helicopters, and other smaller aircraft, because they are less well-guarded than commercial airliners. Joining us from London to analyze this latest report is Chris Yates. He is security editor for Jane's Transport Journals. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
Many of these vulnerabilities we have known about for some time. What do you find the most important information in this report?
There are a whole bunch of issues that really crop up here, but two of the more fundamental questions remain over such like as perimeter security of airports and the background checking of airport employees. Now, it's all well and good to spend billions of dollars putting fancy equipment in airport terminals to scan for such like as explosive materials, but that's bolting the front door when you're leaving the back door open, because at the end of the day, there are many major airports in the United States where people can simply walk through the perimeter fence and get up close and personal with airplanes. And similarly, do we really know that the guy who's loading the bags onto an airplane is not a member of al-Qaeda?
So spending money on fairly exotic things like missile shields, maybe that's not where the focus should be.
No, certainly not where the focus should be. Quite frankly, it's highly unlikely that anybody is going to sit down at the end of the runway at Boston Logan with a shoulder-launched missile and try to pop an airplane out of the sky.
Well, it's been 4 years now, almost, since the 9/11 attack. This is also a huge country. There are hundreds of airports. Is part of the problem that the United States and the aviation system here are simply too big, that you can't protect everything?
There are 400 and odd commercial airports in the United States. This is not rocket science. What should have happened post 9/11 is that the TSA, once it was established, should have taken a cold, hard look at the aviation system and determined the priorities and worked toward those priorities. Instead, what we saw was an agency set up in panic, and lots of money thrown at that agency. And I have to say that some of the spending that the TSA has done is a complete and utter waste of taxpayers' money.
Well, give us some ideas how it might have been done better. I know that Britain faced similar issues, introduced a number of security measures after the Pan Am 103 flight was shot down over Lockerbie in 1988. How did they approach the problem? Did they fix the security issues that were raised by that incident?
Yes, indeed they did. Essentially what happened is that the UK worked for some 4 or so years to come up with a multi-layered security process that really has served the United Kingdom exceptionally well. And that system that we have now is so highly thought of that it's been exported to other countries around the world. What it requires is that one takes a step back from the horror of what happens and then looks very closely at the system and how it's been broken and fixes the system appropriately. And that's not what happened post 9/11 in the United States. We had two inquiries immediately after 9/11, the hurried setting up of the TSA, and an awful lot of money wasted.
Is that where you think most of the blame lies, with the Transport Security Administration?
It's with the Transport Security Administration, it's with the Department of Homeland Security, and even higher up the tree, some of the politicians in the United States, some of those in Congress, should really be taking a certain amount of the blame here as well, because, you know, the major employer in their city, their state, happens to be a defense employer who has the next best thing since sliced bread to such like as missile defense.
Chris Yates, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris Yates is security editor for Jane's Transport Journals. Congress is on the verge of passing the most extensive overhaul of the nation's bankruptcy laws in more than 25 years. The Senate last week passed the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 2005. The House is expected to pass the measure within a few weeks, and President Bush has indicated he will sign the bill. Proponents say the reforms will make the system more fair. Critics argue the changes favor big business at the expense of American families who are having a tough time paying their bills. Well, joining us now for more on the new bankruptcy measure is Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Gail.
Tell us first, what is it about this legislation that makes it so controversial?
Well, the biggest issue that's got the most attention is a restriction on who will be able to file Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which allows people to wipe away their consumer debt and get a fresh start on rebuilding their lives. Under the law, some consumers would have to file under Chapter 13. They would be pushed from 7 to 13, and that calls for debtors to pay back some portion of their debt. The banking, credit card, and retail industries have been pushing for this law for about 8 years, saying many bankruptcy filers have enough income to pay off their debts over time. Critics contend it's another giveaway to big business that will turn consumers into indentured servants.
Well, where is this line drawn? How does the bill determine who can file for Chapter 7 and who has to use Chapter 13?
The bill sets a means test, not a mean test necessarily, a means test for who is abusing the system, and that's the phrase they use in the legislation, abusing the system. It revolves around median household income in the filer's state and IRS guidelines they've set up to establish acceptable monthly expenses in cases where people owe back taxes. So people with incomes above the state median will be the ones most affected, and those are people that the credit card industry contends can and should be paying back their debts. It is estimated the legislation will push between 30,000 and 100,000 bankruptcy filers out of Chapter 7 and into Chapter 13.
Well, there's a lot being said here about abuse. Do we know how much of this alleged abuse has actually been going on in the bankruptcy system?
Well, that is a big question and one that's been debated during the considerations on Capitol Hill. Proponents of the legislation portray some bankruptcy filers as deadbeats who run up big debts, enjoy a lavish lifestyle, and then stick creditors with the tab by easily and painlessly filing for bankruptcy. This no doubt has happened in some cases, but most bankruptcy experts and some recent studies indicate that most people filing for bankruptcy have experienced some kind of trauma in their lives. It could be an expensive medical problem, a loss of a job, or a divorce, which can wreak havoc on family finances. Opponents of the legislation say the current system already has mechanisms for weeding out abuses and that the new law reduces the flexibility available to bankruptcy courts and sets some harsh income standards for determining who must pay back their bills.
Well, now, several major loopholes for the wealthy were left intact in this legislation. What are those?
That's right. And there was debate about these and attempts by opponents to roll some of them back. One is a homestead exemption that would allow bankruptcy filers to keep very expensive homes in some states like Florida and Texas. So those homes would not have to be sold as part of a bankruptcy filing as long as the owners have had the homes for 3 years and 4 months. So if some rich person has a $1 million home in Florida or Texas, that's off the table, and whatever they're forced to pay back, that $1 million value will not be counted. So not many people can use that, but that's available to some. The bill also preserves the so-called asset protection trusts that can be set up in several states, which are also exempt from being used to pay off debts in a bankruptcy. And many doctors have set these up in recent years to protect against malpractice claims. And the Wall Street Journal says that some business executives are also setting up these accounts to protect their assets.
Now, as we noted earlier, this is the first time in 25 years that this legislation is coming through now. So what's behind it? Why have the credit card and banking and retail industries been pushing so hard to get this through?
Well, we have seen a rather dramatic rise in bankruptcy in recent years, Gail. According to the American Bankruptcy Institute, there were 1.1 million Chapter 7 bankruptcies filed last year. Again, those are the ones that give you the clean slate. And that's double the number that was filed in 1994. So in about 10 years, we've seen a doubling of the Chapter 7 filing. So the stakes are a lot higher. There's a lot more money at stake. A lot more debt is being written off. And these companies say that it's cutting into their profits when they have their customers go belly up, and that a lot of those customers could be paying back at least some of the debt.
Well, do we know why the rate of bankruptcy filing has gone up so much?
Well, you know, if you look at what's been going on in the economy, some of the big trends and themes that we're dealing with involve the downsizing of millions of jobs in corporate America, offshoring of jobs, and that's set a lot of people adrift in their careers and their incomes have been hurt. We've seen medical costs rising rapidly. We have 45 million Americans without health insurance. Three quarters of them, by the way, are either employed or dependents of people who are employed. So a lot of folks are getting big medical bills. And we've seen very aggressive marketing of credit by lenders. It's a national joke how many credit card offerings people get in the mailbox. And lenders have expanded their marketing to higher risk consumers, the so-called subprime market. It's given a sort of a democratization of credit, but it's extended credit to a lot of people that are a little shakier. And it's set up a situation where people are getting into debt and they can manage as long as nothing goes wrong. But, you know, when they hit a bump in the road in their lives, they get tossed overboard and they end up in bankruptcy court.
In the end, does this legislation as written really adequately address some of the problems that we've been describing in the bankruptcy system?
Well, clearly some people who file bankruptcy keep their jobs, they keep their incomes, and they do have the ability to pay off at least some of their debts over time. And this legislation would have a lot of people paying back about $5,000 over the course of, or about $6,000 over the course of 5 years. A key issue really is how to fairly identify those people who can pay back their debts and how to set up a repayment schedule that is not draconian. And the sense of the Congress is that they have found the right standards. Obviously, not everyone agrees with that. And it does appear, though, that this legislation will become law and will have an impact on many American households.
So basically, the window here is between now and what, next fall, when this is supposed to go into effect?
Yes, it'll take effect about 6 months after the president signs it, and the president could be signing it, sometime in April. So this is headed soon to a bankruptcy court near you.
All right. Mark Mills, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills joined us here in the studio. When we return, one man's story of having to declare bankruptcy for a second time. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and also tell us the town you're from. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about legislation that will make it harder for some Americans to declare bankruptcy. And joining us on the line from Waltham, Massachusetts, is John. At his request, we are only using his first name. He is planning to declare bankruptcy for a second time. And John, we understand the first time you declared bankruptcy, you had just been discharged from the Air Force. Can you tell us what happened?
I got out of the Air Force and I had a tough time finding proper employment. I was still newly married and had a young infant, and I had a tough time finding a job and also even applying for services, you know, like public aid and stuff like that. And my bills got caught behind, car payment, et cetera, you know, all the stuff that I was able to pay while I was in the military. And I ended up, I had to declare bankruptcy.
And so that wiped out your debt at that point?
Yeah, it was about, I think I had about $20,000 in debt at the time.
And so then, John, after the fresh start, what happened then?
Well, I was going along pretty well for a number of years. And over the last year or so, I've developed serious medical problems and health issues, and I'm on disability. I've actually been on disability for quite a while. My health deteriorated a little bit. And a lot of the creditors weren't that reasonable as far as trying to make payment arrangements or or defer some of the late fees and over limit fees, which a lot of times was caused by their late fees. Thus brings me back to my present action of trying to declare bankruptcy now again.
And child support was a problem also?
Yeah, and it still is a continuing problem. All my kids are grown now. I had accumulated in arrears of a couple of $1,000, which now is up in the 20s because of their fees and penalties, which continue to accrue even right now, even though I'm on disability. And even though I'm declaring bankruptcy, that's one option I don't have, is to declare bankruptcy on the support. That's going to follow me, until I can either pay or whatever.
So basically, as you look at what you owe and the money you have coming in, is there any way that you can pay this off?
No. My best bet is to do what I'm doing, is just to pay an attorney to, do the proper paperwork and file it for me and discharge it. That's all. That's my only hope, because the creditors are going to keep coming for me, getting judgments, and they're coming one after the other, putting notices on my door, and I'm in pretty bad health, and I can't see myself being locked up for a credit card, someone trying to make me pay and incarcerating me with the health that I'm in, I just might as well get a discharge and get a fresh start.
Well, John, what would you say to someone who might look at your situation and say, wait a minute, you declared bankruptcy once. That was supposed to give you a fresh start. It did, and now here you are going back a second time, getting your debts wiped out. Do you think that's fair?
If circumstances warranted, from what I understand, you can do it like every 7 years. It's been more than 7 years since the first time I did. I did it back in, I think it was 82, and now this is, 2005. So I think I've done pretty well to try to make ends meet and to try to, be a proper, bill-paying citizen of this country. So I think I've done pretty well. Circumstances can cause, that situation to happen.
Well, John, we appreciate you sharing your story with us.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And John's attorney, Robert Josephs, joins us now on his cell phone. Robert, we've just heard about some of John's problems. Is his situation unusual?
John is not unusual. He has roughly about $30,000 in credit card debt and $20,000, I believe, in child support arrearage. Unfortunately, John is disabled and unable to work.
Well, Robert, some people would say that it sounds as if John has figured out how to play the system.
No, John is really almost a helpless person in the system. He has used the credit cards to feed himself and to clothe himself and to pay for medical expenses. But the creditors are also charging 25% interest rates, upwards to that amount, and also late fees of anywhere up to $39 and over limit fees of $39. John has made minimum payments on this, and one can even argue that he has paid back the principal on the debt.
Robert, what are some of the factors that determine whether someone like John would be affected by this new bankruptcy plan?
Well, John would not be affected by this bankruptcy reform because he's not working. The most difficult impact is for those two family income families where both parents work and they have two or three children and they put the children in daycare and they have a lot of expenses, yet they make more than the median income in the area. Those people will probably have to be converted to either a Chapter 13 repayment plan or have to try credit counseling initially.
Now, from a practical standpoint, describe for us what Chapter 13 bankruptcy means to people who will be put into that form rather than Chapter 7. Is Chapter 13 less of a fresh start?
Chapter 13 is a longer period of bankruptcy. There's a repayment component of the bankruptcy, and traditionally one's in bankruptcy for 3 to 5 years. So the debtor or client repays between 10% and 100% of the debt depending on the client's disposable income. So the client's in bankruptcy for 3 to 5 years opposed to Chapter 7 where it's 4 months traditionally, and the client, the attorney's fees are upwards to triple the amount of the attorney's fees in a Chapter 7.
Well, I think many of us struggle to pay our bills every month. Doesn't it seem fair that if you run up big debts that you should have to pay at least some of it back?
Well, that's a good argument. The thing is that I don't think the creditors are playing too fair. I really question the long-term commitment that creditors have to their individual clients to really take advantage of them in when they start to get into financial trouble.
Robert Josephs is a bankruptcy attorney in Massachusetts. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether survivors of a 1921 race riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, can seek reparations from the city and the state. Lower courts have ruled that it has been too long since the original incident. But a group of attorneys representing some survivors of the riot disagree, and they see the case as a possible foundation for the legal strategy to collect reparations for the descendants of black slaves. Harvard Law professor Charles Ogletree is leading that group. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Professor, let's start, if we can, with the events in Tulsa on May 31st, 1921. It all started when a young black man was arrested for allegedly assaulting a white woman. Then a mob of whites gathered outside the courthouse where he was being held, and rumors started to circulate that the young man was going to be lynched. What happened then?
Well, it's amazing. One of the things that happened first is that the ultimate charges against the African-American man, Dick Rowland, were dropped because he never committed any crime. That didn't stop the white mob from going to the jail trying to lynch him that night. A fight broke out between black and white men there. Shots were fired. The blacks retreated to Greenwood, which was the 42-block black community. The sheriff then deputized hundreds of white men. Many of them had been drinking. They got weapons from pawn shops and local gun shops. They went into Greenwood and they destroyed what's called Black Wall Street. They burnt the hotels, the theaters, the churches, the newspaper companies. They burnt the private homes, and hundreds of bodies of African Americans have never been found or reported after this violent crime. And none of the whites have ever had to pay any restitution, and none of the blacks have ever received any restitution for one of the greatest examples of domestic terrorism in our time. And it took a report by the state of Oklahoma in 2001 to finally reveal that blacks were the victims, not the cause, and whites were organized to destroy Black Wall Street. And that's why we filed a lawsuit on their behalf to get this back into court.
Let me ask you specifically, why, in your view, are the city of Tulsa and the state of Oklahoma liable for the damage and the deaths, as opposed to those people who participated in the riot and the burnings, et cetera?
Well, as we say in our brief, the city and the state played a visible role in this by organizing people to engage in the conduct. The National Guard was called in and didn't help the African-American victims at that time. And so we know the state and the city's role in clear and unambiguous terms. Many of the people who were involved in 1921 perpetrators are dead, but the city and the state's role continues because they played an essential role in making this happen. The good news is that we also have living survivors. The youngest client I represent now is 89 years old. The oldest living client is 102 years old. These are all African Americans who are actually alive and witnessed what happened in 1921, and that's why they are the visible face of what happened. It's not like more reparations claim when you talk about hundreds of thousands of years ago. We're talking about living, breathing, infirm, some blind, some crippled, some are losing their focus, but they are just as adamant today, 2005, as they were on May 31st, 1921.
What do you want for them, and what do they hope to get out of this if the case was successful?
Well, it's interesting. They want to recover their losses. And what's most interesting, what they've talked about most specifically in terms of reparations, is to try to create education and health care for the next generation of Tulsans. That is, they know that there's not a whole lot that they're going to do with resources as their lives go forward, but they know absolutely that their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, who never had the opportunity to live the way that the Black Wall Street thrived in the 1920s, should have at least an opportunity to get a quality education and good health care.
What's the Greenwood neighborhood like today?
Well, it's been devastated. It looks like an old country town that never has benefited from the progress that was so amazing. The Stratford Hotel was an amazing and nationally renowned place. The Dreamland Theater was amazing. And multiple black newspapers, prominent black churches, doctors, lawyers. So all of that is destroyed, and all you see now are freeways that have cut through there, railroad tracks. And so it looks like it has been hit by an atomic bomb and never quite recovered.
Even today, 80 years later, progress and rebuilding has passed the neighborhood by.
Well, you know, you can see evidence of progress in the sense that there are buildings there, but it's a sad commentary on the amazing first-class community that lived there 84 years ago, more than 84 years ago, and how it is a shell of itself today. And you see these residents walking around and being carried around, and they describe the joy and the excitement of what happened in this fantastic community in 1921. And now they just shed tears when they see how much devastation has occurred. And there was, and one of the other big reasons, oil was very big. There was oil was hitting Tulsa Black's own property where that oil was prominent. And that property was taken, resources were taken, and what would have been an amazingly accomplished and independent and self-sustaining African-American community has been destroyed because of the racist response of a few drunken deputized men and under the watchful eyes of city and state officials.
Professor, I'm wondering, if you're successful in this, in pursuing this before the Supreme Court, does this case, in your view, have repercussions for the pursuit of slavery reparations?
I think it does. We already have some evidence that this is no longer a historic issue, but a modern issue. In the state of Illinois, in the city of Chicago, Alderman Dorothy Tillman has introduced an ordinance requiring corporations that want to do business with the city of Chicago to report their slave connections. And J.P. Morgan originally said they didn't have any slave connections. We found research showing that they did. They looked again, and they said, we do have connections. And they, on their own initiative, decided to apologize to all Americans, and particularly all African Americans, for their connections. And they've already given $5 million, which is a nominal sum, but at least a symbolic sum, $5 million, for scholarships for African American students in Louisiana, where they had slaves as capital, as collateral in some cases. So it is at least a way of looking at the past. It's not all about money, as some people might suggest. It really is about going back and correcting our history and finding a way to have a dialogue about why can't we all get together going forward and acknowledge this is not an issue of black history. This is American history. This is not a black tragedy. It's an American tragedy. As we should be concerned about the tragedy of 9/11, as we should be concerned about the Holocaust, as we should be concerned about the tragedy of Japanese Americans during the Second World War and internment camps, we also should be concerned about the African Americans who lost their lives, their businesses, their homes, and their dignity on May 31st, 1921. That's all we can do, is to look at this as a part of our history, correct it, and move forward.
Charles Ogletree is a professor at Harvard Law School and the lead attorney in the case seeking reparations for the 1921 Tulsa race riot. Still to come, dating on demand right in your home through cable TV. You're listening to Here and Now. The woman held hostage by Brian Nichols, the suspect in Atlanta's courthouse killings on Friday, made pancakes, talked about her daughter and about God while she was held captive. Ashley Smith said that throughout her ordeal, she tried to win Nichols' trust.
I just felt that one or two things were going to happen. Either I was going to walk out of there alive or I was going to be dead. And I just really said, okay, I'm going to show him who I am. I'm going to be me.
Ashley Smith called 911 after she was released. Police surrounded her apartment, and Brian Nichols surrendered. Nichols had been on the run for 26 hours after fatally shooting three people in the courthouse. He had overpowered the deputy who was escorting him there and grabbed her gun. Friday's shootings have raised concerns about security throughout the nation's courthouses. Joining us on the line from Des Moines, Iowa, is Alan Sobel, Executive Vice President and Director of the American Judicature Society. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Was what happened in Atlanta an aberration, or are there many unsafe courthouses?
Well, what happened in Atlanta was certainly an aberration in the sense that we rarely hear about judges or court officials or law enforcement officers who are responsible for protecting the security of courthouses being injured or killed in the line of duty. But whether courthouses are safe or unsafe is really the $64,000 question.
Well, what can be done specifically to make the courtrooms and the courthouses safer?
Well, I think that many courthouses are using sensible measures to make the courthouses and the courtrooms secure. I do have some concerns about why, for example, this defendant was brought into the courtroom with an armed escort, why the defendant was not brought in handcuffs and brought in before the jury was brought into the courtroom. Some of these standards that I'm thinking about would have prohibited an armed escort and would have suggested that he should have been brought in handcuffs and placed at counsel table before the jury was brought back to the courtroom.
And then at the opposite end of that spectrum, concerns that security could go too far. What are the issues there about turning courtrooms and courthouses into armed fortresses? They're already pretty formidable-looking buildings, aren't they?
Well, they're formidable-looking buildings, but there are also efforts to make the public feel welcome. There are a number of concerns that are raised by providing so much security that clearly we create a safe environment, but one that makes possibly the wrong suggestions to the public. For example, in a criminal trial, you could beef up security to the point that the jury reads into the situation the fact that this is a dangerous person on trial and that may well influence their judgment in a particular case. And, you know, the courthouse is the public's building. It doesn't belong to the judges and the staff that work there. It belongs to the public, and it needs to be something that's open and inviting with the thought that we have to protect the personnel that work there to the extent that's reasonably practicable.
Well, reasonably, I guess, is the key point here. There was a legendary judge in Florida who used to carry a gun beneath his robes. Do you think more judges might be tempted to do the same thing after this case and also the case in Chicago?
Well, they might be tempted, some judges at least, to arm themselves, but I think that raises some concern on my part because the judges should feel secure enough in their work environment to not feel the need to be armed. The amount of protection that's available to a judge outside of the courthouse is very much dependent upon the particular sheriff's department in the county where the judge lives, the resources of that department, and what other priorities the department might have at a given time when a judge needs protection. We need to somehow develop standards for the protection of our government officials so that they receive this at least a minimum level of protection in whatever jurisdiction they might be located.
Well, in the meantime, are you concerned that fewer and fewer people will be willing to serve on the bench, or does that simply come with the territory?
It may influence some people, particularly those who do not want to expose their families to any risk of danger because of the occupation that they might choose to enter into.
Alan Sobel is Executive Vice President and Director of the American Judicature Society. Alan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Harris, it's here and now. The next wave of dating is coming to a living room near you. It's called Dating on Demand. Comcast Cable launched the service nationwide last month. All you have to do is press a few buttons on your cable remote control, and you can call up hundreds of videos of people looking for love.
I radiate energy and fun and excitement.
Somebody would find me quite interesting, and they would have a good time with me as well.
I'm looking for somebody with goals and somebody who's geared towards having a stable career.
The videos are free to watch, but if you want to connect with someone, you have to join an online dating website. The service was test marketed in Philadelphia last summer, and that's when Sean Luciano tried it out. He is a 28-year-old chemist and joins us on the line. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
So can you tell us what attracted you to this service in the first place?
Prior to going through Comcast service, I had been using some online dating sites and also some of the speed dating. One of the nice things about the video profiles is that more of the personality of the person translates. You get to see the person speaking. You get to see mannerisms, facial expressions. And you get a much better sense of who the person is.
So is this basically the electronic equivalent of eyes meeting across a crowded room?
I suppose, although it's one-way eyes, initially at least.
Does the fact that this is basically instant dating make it easier in the sense that all you have to do is click a few buttons and a lot of the work's been done for you?
I guess the elbow work is done for you. I mean, you know that the people that you're looking at on the television are people that are single and people that are interested in having a relationship. After that, I think, you're still back to the grindstone as far as going through the motions.
Well, at least you hope they're single, because isn't that a problem in some of the other online services, is that people can say essentially whatever they want?
It's the case with meeting in person. It's the case with meeting online, and I suppose it would be the case with this as well.
What are you looking for when you look at someone's profile?
Oh, boy. This is a really hard question. Through the video profiles, you can tell a great deal about the person. If they look at the camera and are comfortable up there, you know that they're confident and they're not shy. Somebody that's, insecure or intimidated might not look at the camera so much, might look around, fidget a lot. So you can pick up on things like that. You can also get a sense of how intelligent someone is just by the vocabulary they use and how they speak.
Well, Sean, I hope you don't mind. We're going to put you to the test. We have a few clips from some of the profiles we want to play for you. Ashley, a 22-year-old reporter and makeup artist.
A major turn-on for me is a guy who's super smart, driven, and dedicated to his work and really being successful in life. And a major turn-off is any guy with a cheesy pickup line, definitely.
Maria, who is a 29-year-old woman in the entertainment industry.
Let me tell you what I'm not looking for. I don't want a liar. I've been in a lot of relationships where I've been lied to. It's not a good feeling. I want someone who's upfront like me. I'm honest. Somebody who's an animal lover, because I am.
All right, Sean, any reaction to Maria or to Ashley?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I did a date with Maria, so I did meet her.
And?
even without that, is it Ashley?
Ashley was the first, yes.
Yeah, Ashley's, you can tell that she's younger, but she's much more upbeat and bubbly. I think I'm biased in this case.
Well, Sean, I have to confess, we looked at your profile, and you're a pretty good-looking guy. Why not just find dates the old-fashioned way?
Oh, well, I do that, too. But sometimes when you approach someone, besides not knowing if they're available or interested in dating or having a relationship, they can be very standoffish just because they expect your intentions to be, I guess, not the best.
What's the memory that lingers for you from some of the dates you've had?
Well, just that, just like in all walks of life and in the bar scene as well, you're going to come across people who are open and honest and genuinely nice people. And you're going to also come across people that are deceitful and are using this as a tool for entertainment and are not taking it seriously. So you kind of have to have your guard up somewhat, but I think you still have to be open to the possibility that it could work.
Sean Luciano is a 28-year-old chemist from the Philadelphia area. Sean, thanks for talking with us, and good luck with your search.
Thank you so much.
We now want to turn to Dr. Mike Adams. He is an internet relationship expert and a clinical psychologist. He's joining us on the line from his home in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Gail. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good.
We heard, as you just did, from Sean about why he's interested in this service. What do you think the appeal is?
The major appeal actually is convenience when you think about it. A lot of people are interested in meeting other people, but they just don't seem to have the time in their busy lives to go about it in traditional formats. So, of course, we've got, like Sean said, he goes online. That's a very, very popular venue. And now with Comcast Test marketing this, you're going to find another very convenient way for people to at least check out other people in the convenience of their home. So convenience is the number one factor.
Does this mean that we are just too busy in this society if we're having to make human connections through our cable TVs?
You know, that's a very, very fair question. And I would counter that by saying possibly some of us are too lazy to really take the time to get to know somebody in more traditional ways. However, having said that, you know, one thing that Sean was alluding to before when he was talking to you, which I think is fascinating, is on the internet, whereas you may look at a static picture, if you will, or a profile, what this video allows you to do is size the person up in a more robust way. Because, you know, if you think that about 70% of our information is gleaned nonverbally through mannerisms, dress, posture, things like that that he was alluding to, it adds a whole other dimension to being able to size people up rapidly.
So you get much more from a video than you would from a still picture.
Well, you do. You know, it doesn't tell you the whole picture either, of course, but it tells you more than just something that is static. Now, the other thing I want to mention real quick is the fact that geography becomes really interesting, because now you can live literally, you can live in the middle of nowhere and access the service and quite literally go all over the country and check people out. And that's what people actually do. They don't just look in their neighborhood or city. They'll look nationally sometimes.
Actually, we have some numbers about the online dating service experience. There was a study that showed 61% of the people who use the services lie about themselves. 31% are already married or in a relationship. So as this study shows, overall satisfaction is low, why are people continuing to use these services?
Because a lot of them will still think, you know, I have nothing to lose. I may meet Mr. Right or I may meet Ms. Right. And the thing about it is it's another way for people to connect. What happens after they connect, of course, is up to them. And if we look at the offline statistics of failures in relationships, you know, they're probably pretty comparable. I mean, people unfortunately lie, you know, in real life as well as on the net.
What would you say are the overall prospects for this? Is it going to take off?
I don't think it's going to take off like a rocket. I think it'll probably have some success in the marketplace. The reason for that is, if you remember, when the video cams first came out that people could put onto their computers so that people could see each other in real time, while those remain somewhat popular, they never took off quite like manufacturers anticipated they would, because people still do want to reserve their privacy. They really don't want to necessarily be seen in the public eye quite that quickly.
Always trying to strike a balance between mystery and full disclosure.
Exactly.
Dr. Mike Adams is a clinical psychologist and internet relationship expert. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much, Gail. Have a great day.
Thank you. You do the same. And earlier, we also spoke to Sean Luciano, a 28-year-old man from Philadelphia, who is using the Dating on Demand service. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.